was only 50 years ago that the celebrated digital computer, ENIAC, short for Electronic Numerical Integrator and Calculator, was built at the University of Pennsylvania. ENIAC weighed 30 tons, occupied 1,800 square feet of floor space, and got its smarts from 17,000 vacuum tubes. To keep those tubes working, it took 6 full-time technicians running around replacing them as they randomly blew out like 4th of July fireworks. ENIAC often had to be debugged, quite literally, because the glowing vacuum tubes attracted moths that would gum up its circuits. In 1947, the transistor was invented at Bell Labs. Based on the new physics of semiconductors like silicon and germanium, the transistor was smaller, lighter, more reliable, longer lasting, and less energy intensive than the vacuum tube, and no moths got stuck in it. Besides being useful for computers, they also led to the portable transistor radio, which was introduced to consumers in 1954. Of course, the transistor radio's popularity was fueled by that strange new music, rock and roll. In the late 1950s, transistors and computers took a great step forward when engineers invented the integrated circuit, or microchip, a sliver of silicon that would eventually incorporate millions of transistors and launch a multi-billion dollar global industry. In 1974, Intel introduced a microchip with enough calculating power to form the brains of the first personal computer, the Altair. In 1975, that Altair made its debut as a $400 kit. The Altair was hard to assemble, didn't work all that well, and came with no external memory, no printer, and no keyboard. It had limited programming capability, and data entry required flipping toggle switches on the front. And yet Altair was a big hit with hobbyists, the build-your-own crystal radio crowd, who sensed that they were on the front line of a technological revolution. The hobbyists were right. Today, 20 years after the Altair, 145 million PCs have been sold in the U.S. alone. Sure, PCs need to get a little smarter. If you ask a common word processing program to check the grammar of the sentence, "She graduated from Notre Dame," the program will respond, "Sexist expression. Avoid using Dame except as a British title." As the New Yorker magazine quipped, "They don't call them PCs for nothing." Thus, while computers are faster and capable of processing more data than ever before, the frustration continues to be that computers are barely able to learn, to really think like humans. No researcher has spent more time struggling to solve this dilemma than Marvin Minsky, Toshiba Professor of Media Arts and Sciences at MIT. Professor Minsky is the father of artificial intelligence, having co-founded MIT's famous artificial intelligence lab in 1958. He has labored long and hard to help design thinking machines. In doing so, he has also sought to fathom how that intricate piece of machinery and genius, the human brain, actually works. Minsky is at once a tinkerer and a theoretician. He is just as at home pulling apart a circuit board or fixing his ancient jukebox as he is speculating about whether human-machine hybrids will eventually succeed our species. I talk with Dr. Minsky at his invention-filled home near Boston. Did you build machines when you were a kid?
Yes, all the time, I think, even from the moment of birth. I was just always fascinated in how you make big things out of little things or complicated things out of simple things. But when I was a little kid, the most thrilling thing was Tinker Toy, because Tinker Toy is simpler than everything else. There's just these little round spools with holes in them and these little sticks. And you stick the stick in the hole and another one, and there's your thing, and put a couple more, and you've got a square, and then there's holes in the side, and you've got a cube. You can make two cubes and stick them together. And in a few minutes, out of just these two elements, it's like chemistry where there's only one atom and one bond, but carbon would be the ideal thing. And once I built a huge, we were in a hotel lobby, and somehow I had, somebody gave me enough Tinker Toy, and it was a great tower. And I kept building slightly bigger cubes, and then you carefully lift this whole thing and put it on the next one. And there were these adults coming around, and they were saying, how could such a little child build such a big thing? And I was saying, how could such a big adult be so stupid? Because there's nothing to it. You just keep adding more. There's nothing to it. There's nothing big in a big thing.
You grew up in New York?
I grew up in New York, and my father was a surgeon who had all sorts of instruments, and I was always taking those. He was an eye surgeon and had lenses. I loved optics. And I would destroy all sorts of things, and he would calmly put them back together. And after a while, he got tired of that, so he had a friend in the junk business, and one day this truck came up with all kinds of radios and mechanical things and dumped them in the backyard, and that was probably the largest single influence in my life, because I could now do anything, switches and lights and
take everything apart,
motors, take them apart and sometimes put them together. So that became, looking back, I was always interested in, if you see something complicated, what are its little parts and how do they work and how do you understand it? And eventually, I just came to the point that nothing cannot be understood. Whatever it is, you can always eventually find what its parts are and how they work and how this new phenomenon that you wouldn't believe could come out of those parts can. And that's science, and that's computer science especially, because computer science changed everything. Before 1950, you couldn't make a theory of how the brain worked because you didn't know how to describe that sort of complicated process. Mathematics was good for some things, but mathematics is peculiar. It's no good for describing a system that has a lot of ifs in it. If this happens, then do that. If this happens, do that. Mathematics breaks generally when you've got a lot of those, but the real world is full of them. So computer science is not just about computers, it's about how to think about complicated processes.
So tell me about the first machine that you designed, the first thinking machine, rudimentary thinking machine.
Right, I wanted to build a machine that could get better at things. And so the first question is, how do you make a machine that will learn at all? And the obvious thing to do is to have the machine try different things and remember which ones worked. And that means you have to build several parts, you have to make a little environment in which there's some task for it to accomplish, like find its way through a maze. And then you have to give it some way of trying different things each time it gets to one of the paths. And finally, you have to get some system for remembering so that when it comes back to a certain situation, it's more likely to do what it did in the past.
So the task was to run a maze, correct? Just like old psychological experiments with a rat running a maze.
Yes, although the maze is really a whole set of smaller problems. When it does something you like, then you send a signal in from the other end, and any unit that made a decision that led to a good result is going to get modified. In fact, I have one of the 40 simulated nerve synapses here. This must have been built in 49 or so.
This was a tabletop computer with 40 of these guys.
Yes, well, it was about the size of a grand piano, actually, because it had a lot of these. And the signals come in on some of these pins and go out on others. And basically, the way it worked is if a signal comes in on this pin, it has a certain probability of coming out on this side or that side. And that probability is determined by this old volume control. This is all made of World War II surplus. And what would happen is that from the outside, there's just a big network of these. In fact, they're connected to each other at random. And when the machine does something you like, you press a button, and what happens is that the knob is turned just on the units that did the right thing, so to speak. And if it did the wrong thing, you could arrange it so it would turn them down. But anyway, I built this thing in about 1951, and for easy problems, it was very exciting because you could just reward it when it did the right thing, and after a few minutes, it would do it all the time.
When was the term artificial intelligence coined? That was in the early 50s?
Yes, John McCarthy, who was at Dartmouth at the time, noticed that there were several people interested in this sort of thing of building thinking machines, we like to call it, and he called this thing a conference on artificial intelligence, and the word stuck.
And that was what year, do you remember?
It's in the summer of 1956, and we searched around for people who were interested in this, and we had a pretty high score. There were about 10 or 12 people at this conference, and they all turned out to be significant contributors to the field.
And then you co-founded the Artificial Intelligence Project at MIT?
McCarthy and I started a laboratory at MIT. Basically, I got there at around 1958, and John came around 1959, and we started to have students and declared our group of students to be a laboratory.
So the idea was to build a thinking machine. Now, these first ones were what are called rule-based.
Here's the problem. If you know how to solve a problem, you can write a program to do it, if you know exactly what to do. But how do you make a machine that's smarter than that and can solve problems that you didn't program it to do? It's easy to write a program which will systematically try billions of different combinations of arrangements to solve a problem, and then just wait till it's solved, and then stop and boast, here we have it. But that takes a long time, has no understanding, and the point I'm trying to make is that there is no mystery of creativity. There's no problem at all in getting a machine to do something new that nobody's ever thought of, because it can just, not even randomly, but systematically try all possibilities. The secret of being creative is making something that's not very new, but just a little bit different in the right direction. And that was sort of clear to everyone who thought about how you'd make machines solve problems. But it meant that the theories that you need are not theories of how to generate all sorts of possibilities, but how to confine these exploding. It's like a tree. You have a trunk and then 20 branches, and each of them has 20 branches. Now you've got 400. If each of those has 20 branches, it's 8,000. Doesn't sound like much, but you do that 10 times, and you're talking about hundreds of millions of branches. And so what we focused on was, how do you prevent these search trees from growing too large? How do you use common sense, or how do you use mathematical theories or whatever, to keep the machine from trying things that are totally off the wall? And that's why I gave up this idea of having a huge random network with 40 different things flipping coins and hoping something good will happen. Anyway, the field of artificial intelligence has split up now. It's a big, big field. There's 100,000 people in the world who are working on different ways to get machines to solve problems, and some of them are using random search, and some of them are using an interesting kind of reasoning which is called fuzzy logic, which is like probability, it's like random, only it has a more intuitively understandable way of combining things. Then at another extreme, you have people using pure mathematical logic. There are about 20 different ways to represent knowledge in computers today. So what I'm trying to do is say, how do we take these 20 different good ideas about how to represent knowledge in computers and manage them? So I'm working less on the knowledge than how do you make managers and managers for them, and what happens if two of them conflict? Do you have a jury trial? Do you just let the strongest one win? Do you somehow add them up? Again, for everything we know how to do, we usually know several ways. And the difference between my research and most others is that instead of saying which is better in a sort of silly sports competitive way, I'm saying how can we make a new kind of machine which uses all of those other old ones and has the knowledge of when to use this and when to use that and how to combine all these good ideas. And it seems to me that if you're to become an expert, and this is what I'm trying to get into modern computer programming, there are two things you need. You need to know what to do to solve a problem, and you need to know what you shouldn't do. Which are the most common bugs? If you're trying to do something new like woodworking, one of the things I learned is that if you're holding a piece of work and tightening a screw, you shouldn't be doing that because eventually it'll slip, and I don't see any scars. But the point is that an expert is someone who has both the positive knowledge of skill and lots of negative knowledge. He knows all the common mistakes, and that means he'll very rarely make a mistake. You hardly ever go out the window instead of the door. You never think of it. And one of the troubles with education theory until recently is that people had this idea that the best way to learn is to make it a positive experience. Everything should be good. The child should be guided to make very small steps so that they can't make any serious mistakes, and then you learn everything, and when you're all done, you can do the job without thinking because you know exactly what to do. Well, I don't think that kind of learning leads to becoming very good at new problems because you haven't learned enough about bugs. So what we've really got to do is to teach children to enjoy being wrong.
So how do you build insight into a machine? I mean, it seems that you know, we have machines now. I mean, a Pentium-based computer beat the world chess champion, at least, you know, in the odd game or so. And in that computer works, as I understand it, by looking at, you know, churning out millions of possibilities somehow to evaluate. I mean, how do we get beyond that?
Well, I think the reason machines don't seem very intelligent now is that the programmers are always trying to find the best way to solve each problem. And my feeling is that in the future, we're going to change that. Every time you have a problem, you're going to get several different people to write different programs for solving it. And each of them will work sometimes and not others. And then there'll be yet another couple of people who will write managers who try to write a program deciding for this problem which of those methods to use. And so it's a higher level. Right now, machines only do what they're told in a clumsy sense. You start saying, here's a job, which program to run. I think what people do is you try something, you see where it goes wrong, and you use that as more information to sort of go back and say, okay, what's good at doing it this way without that problem? And insight, I think, doesn't exist as a single magic thing, but maybe as a million common sense bits of knowledge that you've accumulated, and some people have woven them together in a much better pattern than others.
I mean, how do you build that kind of common sense into a machine? I mean, when you started, I guess it was in the 60s, where you were building the program that was assembling blocks and trying to build a tower. I mean, didn't you find that the machine missed all sorts of common sense things? Starts to build the tower from the top down, where you could never do that, it would fall apart.
Yes, that was a wonderful example. Or we had a machine whose job, we tried to write a program which would look at one structure, which might be a little house, and there was a pile of blocks on the table, and the machine's job was to build another structure just like this one. Well, when you first look at that, it doesn't look hard. We'll just take each block there and put a corresponding block here. And then the bug is, of course, you might look at the roof first and you put it there and it just falls down.
So the problem is, as soon as you start to articulate what these, you know, common sense things are that go on behind the scenes in our head, I mean, don't you quickly end up with like an infinite list of these? I mean, how would you build all this into a machine?
Yes, the question is two things. How big is common sense knowledge? And no one knows. I think it's only a few millions of things, little items. Anyway, in the blocks world, we finally found about 20 ideas that allowed it to build a lot of things, but not everything. And then one of the students discovered that there were things that one couldn't do. Sometimes you can't build a structure out of blocks unless you build some props first and then remove them. And so that's more common sense. Well, it would be very nice to have a machine that knew all of the, as many of things about the real world as a child does, say a six-year-old child.
But I mean, clearly the approach to try to articulate all the things that a six-year-old knows, or a three-year-old, or a two-year-old, I mean, isn't that ultimately doomed to failure, or it will be, you know, eons before anyone can do that? I mean, isn't the idea to get a machine to learn these kind of things the way we do? I mean, it's not as if a kid has a, you know, Newton's books on gravity to learn that you have to stack blocks going up. So how do you do that?
That's a very interesting question, because clearly there are two extreme paths. One path would be hire a lot of people to try to write down all of common sense knowledge and represent it in a computer.
People are doing that, right?
There's only one group doing a good job of that. I'm annoyed that there aren't 20, because it's hard for a science to develop without competition and different groups. But anyway, there's a man named Douglas Lennett who has a project called PSYC, short for encyclopedia, and he's been for some years trying to represent common sense knowledge. Now, if that system were publicly available on the internet or something, and we knew how to funnel different contributions into it, then we could have 100,000 people adding to it. And so even if the machine didn't learn, I think it would be very useful to make several attempts to just code the knowledge, because it's not infinite. There's just so much a child could learn in 10 years, and that would be nice. So the other approach is, how do you make an infant that can learn, a machine with very little knowledge and lots of learning machines? And that would be nice too, only we don't know how to do it, and there hasn't been enough work on how to make machines that can learn on many levels at once. And I think that both of these are important. The brute force programming of a lot of knowledge, I think, will be very useful in the short term, and but eventually we should be able to understand how babies learn.
I mean, as we sit here today, I mean, what is the most sophisticated learning machine?
The most sophisticated learning machines are ones that aren't even considered to be learning machines. Really, there's a few researchers who have written programs, computer programs, that solve problems by analogy. You have one problem, and you have a little library of other problems that you've solved. And so instead of saying, how do I solve this problem, the first thing you say is, what problem in my library or in my past is this most like?
What kinds of problems would these
okay,
be? I'm just trying to get a sense of where we are in computer science now.
I had a student who did a very interesting one of these, analogy-based reasoning problem solver. And in fact, she used the PSYC program that Lennett was developing. And so what she did was, she said, suppose that you had the problem of designing a computer for a hotel to keep track of accounts. And she's saying, well, of course, I could just have some programmer come in and say what to do with the bills and the room assignments and so forth. But what she did was, she had two other cases. Instead of a million things, she only had a very small set of ones. She already had a program for managing the accounts of a car rental agency, and she had one for managing a hospital. And so here's this new, now remember, this program isn't like a child who's heard of a million things. It's only heard of a very small number of things. And here's this thing called a hotel. So it asks you, what's a hotel? And you say, well, this is where people check in. What's check in? It takes a long time to talk to this thing. But they get a room, and they keep it for a few days, and then they sign out, and you send them a bill. So it understands hotel in that sense. It doesn't even know what a person is. Well, then it looks through these files and say, well, this is very much like a car rental agency, except I don't know what a room is, but is a room like a car? It asks. It's interactive. And she tells it this and that, and after a while it does it pretty well. And so then it gets a lot of properties of what the car accounting system was like. Then it does it for the hospital, and that has some features like they don't all check out, which is too bad. And, well, it actually came up with a good outline for this new program by combining the features of the old ones. So that's a kind of knowledge-based reasoning, which isn't like logic. It's not deducing so much. It's using similarities. And then if this problem is like that problem that you've solved, the big task is which of the differences matter and which don't. So that's a new kind of knowledge that's never been in computers, really. How important is one feature rather than another?
How do you respond to people that say, well, it's all well and good that a computer beat Garry Kasparov, the world chess champion, but it's not really doing what we do? Because after all, if we beat someone at chess, we rejoice in it, we may savor the victory. A computer's not experienced any of that and never will. But you see a day coming when machines could be disappointed or happy or stressed out or angry.
Yes, in fact, I think that some of the feelings, like disappointment, the machines will have to have if they're going to be smart. That is, it won't be just enough for a machine to say, well, I failed to solve that problem, I'll try it a different way. What you want is another part of the machine that reviews this and broods about it, let's say, and says, what did I do wrong? Well, I know what I did wrong, but why did I do that wrong? Maybe it was because I had prioritized this goal ahead of that, and that's why I didn't think of that. I know, as a mathematician, whenever one of the other mathematicians solve a problem, what's my reaction? Well, of course, it's nice. One less problem, there's still an infinite number. We're never sorry to see a problem solved. But then another part of my brain says, oh, how stupid, I could have done that if I had just thought of this instead of that. And it's all so obvious. And I think those emotions, this disappointment and this selfishness and this pride and feeling ashamed, these are highly evolved mechanisms that help us solve problems. And they're not transcendental luxuries that are just clipped onto a robot. We're not just a machine that happens to have feelings that don't affect us. Those feelings, for which we have only these dumb words right now, are actually complicated mechanisms, and I'll bet in the next 20 years we'll know a lot about some of them.
I mean, do you see a point where machines will become more intelligent than us? Are we the last in the evolution of intelligence?
I personally think that we're the last, because at some point in the next century or two, people will suddenly get very angry with having to die. I have lots of friends who say, well, that's natural. There's a time to be born and a time to grow and learn, and there's a time to die and throw everything you've learned away and have it erased. And people are used to that. You might as well be if there's nothing you can do about it. But I think that in the next 100 years, there will be something we can do about it. And if your brain cells, if your heart goes bad, you can get a new heart. If your brain cells go bad, you can put in new chips. And at some point, we'll pass over the margin where you can take everything in your being of value, all your ideas and memories and ways of thinking, and transfer them into another piece of hardware that has replaceable parts, and will live forever, essentially, and you can keep adding more memory, and you have to build a whole new set of ideas about what is life and what are our goals, because if you have the option of living and learning for a billion years, you might do things differently.
So, I mean, you really see a day when we'll be able to replace neurons, damaged neurons, with microchips. I mean, what technologies need to be achieved in order for us to do that?
I don't think it will take any new technology. It's just that we don't know how to build it. Now, by the time
we know... In other words, we have the memory technology, but we don't know what to do with it.
We have the technology for making serial and parallel computers and memory and all that stuff. And I'll bet that once you have a theory of how the brain works, you'd be able to simulate it on a big supercomputer. And a big supercomputer, 20 years after that, will be a little one, and 20 years after that ought to be about this size. So I don't think we will need new technologies, but it's irrelevant because we get new technologies every 5 or 10 years as it is. But the main problem is we don't have enough people thinking about how do brains work, how could we make artificial ones.
being practical again for a moment, what are some of the things that artificial intelligence is actually used for out in the real world? I mean, what are some of the programs that people use? Do you prospect for oil using artificial intelligent programs? Or,
well, that's interesting. One of the problems in saying what artificial intelligence is useful is that anything that's useful gets its own name pretty soon. So, for example, in the 1960s, we worked on the problem of how to make a machine recognize printed characters or handwritten characters. I supervised a master's thesis of a student, and he made something that was pretty good at recognizing single handwritten characters, but it failed completely on cursive ones. Well, now for printed characters, you can buy programs that do that, and they're called OCR, optical character recognition. And nobody thinks of them as intelligent, and in a sense, nothing is intelligent. I think the word intelligence doesn't refer to things. It refers to a relation between you and something else. You call someone intelligent if they can do something with their mind that you can't, and you're sort of jealous or you admire it. But as soon as you understand how it's done, you say, oh.
Like a magic trick.
It's like a magic trick. Now that I know the trick, it's not so interesting. Well, there are lots of things out in the world, they're called expert systems of various sorts, that do useful functions in business and in engineering and so forth, that were once research projects in universities or laboratories, and they were called artificial intelligence. But once they're out there, they're just called rule-based system for some job. Now, there's another side of this which is more serious. There is no computer program that has anything like the common sense of a young child or normal person. So all computer programs today are specialized. They're experts. They just know one thing or a couple of things. And if you stray out of that area, they're worse than an infant. They can't even learn anything. So we don't have any programs that are intelligent in the ordinary sense you use the word, of an entity, of a person or something that can do a lot of things, and what's more, when it's stuck, it will figure out something else to do or it can learn a new job. And that doesn't exist, and I think it's mostly because to do that you have to have a lot of knowledge about different things. It's not just pure reason. You've got to know stuff about the world to solve problems, and that's coming, but very slowly. So for me, there's been a sort of plateau.
What are some of the research projects that excite you in computer science?
In computer science, not very many. I'm very excited by the common sense projects, but there's only one. I love the people who are working on making machines reason by experience and analogy instead of from frozen libraries of information. But the trouble is those people are a little bit stuck, because to do reasoning by analogy you have to know a lot of things to compare things to, and so there's a kind of difficulty. Now there's some other fads. It's very popular, especially on television, to show projects where people are making little robots that climb over obstacles and that sort of thing. Somehow that's become the rage, and they get a lot of publicity because they're very visual and they work well on television. But I haven't seen significant discoveries. One area that is very thrilling is that people are simulating aspects of evolution. If computers are so big and cheap now that you can describe, for example, a million very simple animals or cells that have a few properties and interact with their neighbors, and then on a supercomputer, you can make up a little genetic system for it, introduce various kinds of mutations.
Watch how they evolve.
And see what happens. And in many cases, people have been immensely surprised by some of these systems not going anywhere and some evolving much faster than anybody thought. And that's very thrilling. And there are hundreds of people doing research on artificial evolution now all over the world.
It's called artificial life? Is that the...
They call it artificial life. But most of it is, in fact, simulating more and more sophisticated kinds of genetic evolution rather than trying to just design machines and had the knowledge.
And what computer vision, what's the state of the art in that now in terms of computer being able to see and recognize objects?
Oh, computer vision, I'm sorry you asked that because it's been a great disappointment to me. People have made machines. In the 1960s, we got computers to be able to see simple things like children's blocks. So we, in fact, did make a robot that could recognize blocks on a table and assemble them. But we never got very far with curved blocks. These were just square ones. And we never got far with anything that could change its form, like a shirt, which is changing. So today we have computer vision programs that can recognize particular things, anything that's rigid and has enough features, and you just locate them and look it up in various ways.
So what's been the obstacle to computer vision here? Just vision's much more complicated than we thought, or?
I think vision is complicated. You probably need a lot of knowledge to do it. That is, a child has to learn a lot about the appearances of familiar objects and maybe some more general principles, but I don't know the answer. One clue is that when a human is looking around at things, then a large fraction of the brain seems to be active in that, like a third of the whole brain is involved with vision. And that might suggest that there isn't any easy way, or evolution would have found it, and we would have had more brain to do other stuff with.
Now, how about robotics? I mean, the idea of home robots is sort of a staple of science fiction.
Oh,
cleaning
that.
The bathroom, that. How far are we away from that? I mean, everyone always used to predict these things were, you know, around the corner.
I think you could make a domestic robot as soon as you've made a machine that's as smart as a 5 or 6 year old about common sense objects, and that's the bottleneck. There's no use making a domestic robot if it doesn't understand situations well enough to know that the way to move this pile of things is, here I can pick up the whole thing, this one I better take it from the top, I better hold this while I'm moving that. It's just a whole lot of stuff that nobody's ever done.
So it's
as far away as it always was at the moment.
So almost in summary, I mean, what's holding us back in all these fields, whether it's computer vision, whether it's, you know, sense of touch, it seems to be building in common sense.
Yes, it'd be much it's much easier to make machines do higher mathematics than lower mathematics or than ordinary things.
Thank you, Professor Minsky.
Thanks, Paul. I hope we get a few hundred feet of good film out of this.